but for one gripe. Because Marvel and DC are in the business of building universes, today's superheroes aren't madcap individualists. They're members of solemn collectives like the Avengers or the Justice League. So Peter has a hovering father figure in Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark, a.k.a. Iron Man, and a cranky monitor in Stark's ex-chauffeur Happy, played by Jon Favreau. I know many people let out squeals of delight when miscellaneous Marvel characters pop in, but here they bored me silly. The juice has gone out of Downey Stark, who functions as a scold, and Favreau is a full-time director these days and can't manage more than one cartoonish note. I hold out hope for this new Spider-Man series, though. Peter likes his school and his neighborhood, and the movie's writers use Spidey's famous catchphrase, "Your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man," as a declaration of independence. I hope Marvel recognizes the value, in terms of storytelling anyway, of just keeping it local.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's show...
I've been strapped in, you know, physically.
Nevada Senator Dean Heller promised to repeal and replace Obamacare when he ran for office in 2012. Now, some Republicans in the state wonder, what's the holdup?
Get some business done. You know, oh, we can't do this, I can't do that. Quit Mickey Mousing around. Get some work done, okay?
I'm Kelly McEvers. Our report from Nevada this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tonight on 360 North, Brookings Institution senior fellow Constanze Stolzenmüller offers her analysis of Europe, America's partner or America's problem, before the Juneau World Affairs Council. American Forum looks at the Nixon administration and the perils of presidential ambition at 9. This is America and the World follows at 9:30, The Whole Truth with David Eisenhower at 10, and America's Now at 10:30. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
Stay tuned for a Juneau Afternoon. We'll talk with Claire Imamura about a presentation at the Alaska State Museum about the museum's sesquicentennial exhibit. We'll get a preview of Maud Carousel's performance this weekend with Luminous Pariah. We'll learn about the Carlos Boozer basketball camp, and Kelsey Wood will be here to highlight the Bridge Adult Daycare Center. Taking a quick look at the weather, we are experiencing our mostly sunny period, but it will shift to widespread rain showers this evening with lows in the mid-50s. Numerous rain showers tomorrow, highs around 60. That will continue into tomorrow night and Sunday as well. Stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota's U.S. Congresswoman says an Indian Health Service reform bill is moving quickly through Congress. Kristi Noem has sponsored similar legislation in the past. The bill increases care standards, gives IHS more recruitment tools, and requires more accountability from providers. As Lee Strubinger reports, she gave an update on the bill at a town hall meeting in Rapid City this week.
The legislation is in response to years of reports about poorly delivered care and mismanagement. The Restoring Accountability in the Indian Health Services Act seeks to address both medical care and administrative challenges. Congresswoman Noem says her bill has passed through a subcommittee and is ready for full committee hearings. She says the U.S. Senate is working on similar legislation.
We've got bipartisan support. The Senate is pushing theirs forward, and the chairman of that committee is the prime sponsor of it. So I'm excited that this bill, I believe, will be signed into law. We're going to have much more accountability in that agency and more resources where it needs to be.
Noem and other congressional members have introduced similar legislation in the past. Noem says all this comes as emergency rooms at IHS hospitals in the Rosebud Reservation and Pine Ridge Reservation are struggling to stay open. Officials say the Pine Ridge ER received immediate jeopardy findings in April and May. Rosebuds and an IHS hospital's emergency room in Rapid City closed last year temporarily. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Sealaska Heritage Institute recently published the Beginning Tlingit Workbook. It's part of the ongoing effort to revitalize the language. KTOO's Carter Barrett visited a Juneau Public Library workshop and has this report.
About 15 people are participating in a Tlingit language learning workshop at the library. A group of natives and non-natives are learning a language that only around 100 people speak fluently. On this particular night, they are using pages from the workbook to teach different greetings and responses. Daniel Hernandez was fascinated with the few Tlingit words he learned in his training as a seasonal tour guide in Juneau. He's made going to the Monday night workshop part of his routine.
The information that I got briefed on just really started to fascinate me, so I wanted to learn more. So far, it's amazing. I really love the class. Yeah, I'm really learning a lot.
Quinay Lance Twitchell authored the workbook. He's a fluent Tlingit speaker and professor at the University of Southeast Alaska. He's been at the forefront of revitalizing the Tlingit language, which was nearly destroyed through colonialist efforts that forbid Native children from speaking their language.
If Tlingit is gone, then you have a total linguistic and cultural genocide because people came and attacked this language and really tried to remove it.
The workbook is an extension of The Beginning Tlingit Book by Richard and Nora Dauenhauer and uses a lot of illustrations and pictures to help teach the language.
It would be strange to think to go live in some rural part of France or something and never learn the language. But you can expect that in indigenous areas, and that's part of the sort of colonial mindset.
Twitchell hopes that in 30 years, there will be around 5,000 fluent Tlingit speakers. In Juneau, I'm Carter Barrett.
Michigan's attorney general says the state cannot withhold funds from schools with Indian mascots. Bill Schutte released an opinion this week saying while the superintendent has broad powers, there are no school codes which authorize the withholding of aid as a penalty. Native groups are among those speaking out against Indian mascots. There have been efforts to prohibit public schools in the state from using them. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The third National Gathering of American Indian Veterans celebrating all U.S. military takes place July 21st through the 23rd in Wheaton, Illinois. Information by calling Trickster Art Gallery at 847-301-2090. Proud to support this program. Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills. With rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, this afternoon's volunteer host, with Jeff Brown, our producer. I'd like to welcome to our program our first guest, Claire Imamura from the Alaska State Museum Library and Archives, also known as the Father Andrew P. Kashaveroff Building, as well as Seth Irwin, who is a paper conservator. He is in Boston at this moment. I think, is that right, Seth? You're in Boston?
I'm actually in Cleveland at this moment working on a project for the Intermuseum Conservation Association, but I fly back to Boston tomorrow.
Well, thank you for joining us by telephone. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Glad to have you. Claire, why don't you tell us about the event that will be happening tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the APK building that involves Seth, who will be providing some information and instruction via video conference.
Sure. So Seth was here this spring for about 6 weeks working on treating some maps and manuscripts that are related to the Treaty of Session, which is the transfer of Alaska from Russia to the United States, and it's the 150th anniversary this year. So we're going to have an exhibit that's about the Treaty of Session and the Sesquicentennial that opens this fall at the museum. And so to kind of gear up for that, we're having Seth do a little presentation about the work that he did and also generally what paper conservation is and what people need to know for their own personal papers.
This is fascinating. Claire, does the original Treaty of Cession reside next door at the APK?
Ooh, I don't think that is included in the exhibit. Seth, do you know more about that?
Well, the state archive would be the better person to answer this, but I can tell you that the original treaty is actually not in the exhibit. It's my understanding that the original treaty is actually held by the National Archives in Washington, D.C. The treaty isn't just a single document. It's also lots of corresponding documents and maps and books and things that went along with it. So it's not just one single sheet of paper. But what is in the exhibit is a version of the treaty that was signed by Secretary of State Seward at that time, that actually is in the exhibit.
What are some of the other pieces of paper and items that you worked on, Seth, as part of this show, which we should emphasize, although your workshop is tomorrow at 2 o'clock, the actual sesquicentennial. I've been practicing that. Sesquicentennial, yep. Show of those items will not be in until this fall. But what have you been working on?
Well, the exhibit is centers around sort of two centerpieces. One of them is a painting that was brought from the Seward House in New England area. That's a painting that depicts the purchase of the territory, and that painting is traveling around Alaska as we speak, and will be one of the two centerpieces as part of the exhibit. And then we have, as part of corresponding with that painting, things that went with it. So there are maps and ledgers and population charts and things of that sort that were done at the time to sort of decide what's part of the purchase. You want to know what you're buying. And then the other centerpiece to the exhibit, which I did work on, is a very rare hand-drawn map of Sitka from that time. So it's a hand-drawn map of the town of Sitka, which, as you know, was the original capital. And that map outlines land plots and houses and fences and things of that sort. And that map is 4 by 8 feet. And as part of that map, the state archive, and the state library both have documents and ledgers that directly connect to that map. So as I did work on that map, and I also worked on land plots and deeds that are referenced in that map. So that map is one of the two, will be one of the two centerpieces, and there will be a good part of the exhibit ties directly to those two pieces.
Seth, when you say work on, what does that mean? Give us a little bit of an inside view about what it means to work on paper as a conservator.
So conservation is divided into three areas, painting, paper, and then what we call object, which is wood and metal, feathers, things like that. I specifically work on paper, and I work on anything that's paper-based. So that would include photographs, documents, maps, books, letters, anything, watercolors, anything that's paper-based. So the best answer to that question would be work.
Looks like we lost Seth for a moment there. Claire, in the meantime, I want to ask you about the facility that is included in the APK building that is a paper conservation lab. Talk about what that facility can do, and can the public use it?
Well, so part of the new building, the APK SLAM, was the creation of a paper conservation lab because the library and the archives were moving into the APK, what was formerly the museum. We saw a real need for an area to do paper conservation because we do have a lot of older, rare materials that need help, Seth's help, or another paper conservator. So that space was built. We currently don't have a paper conservator on staff. We do have an objects conservator, Ellen Carley, and so she does that kind of wood, metal, work that Seth was mentioning. So Seth was brought up, and as part of this project, which was funded by the Alaska Historical Commission, he got that paper lab up and running, and now it's ready for a paper conservator to use. It's not open to the public right now,
But we hope maybe in the future that we can have a full-time paper conservator doing work in that space and maybe also being able to take projects from the public.
How does one conserve paper? What is the main process?
You know, Seth would really be the best person to explain his work, but I know some of the things that he worked on, like I saw him washing paper, which I didn't even think was possible because whenever I get paper wet, it just gets
when it goes through
really
the laundry,
brittle.
It's not a pretty sight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he knows how to like get deteriorating.
Hi, Seth. We're glad to have you back. I was just asking.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Yeah.
I was just asking Claire, how does one conserve paper? We were talking about the paper conservation lab that is part of the new APK / SLAMP. So how does one conserve paper?
So one of the one of the best references for this would be that large map. And that map in particular was repaired over many years by hand. By various librarians and archivists using tape. The good intentions. They repaired it, they taped it, and held it together with tape. Well, that has long. Tape is one of my nemesis. I spend about half of my time taking tape off of things. And that map had somewhere around 8 feet of cumulative tape on it, which took me about a week just to get all of the tape off of that map. And then I do other things like repairing holes and tears and stains and various forms of corrosive elements in paper and anything that you could think of that would be damaging, mold, dirt, grime, that's all part of what I do. I fix that.
I picture you using like a Q-tip to do this. It must be a very
that
careful process.
Q-tips and swabs are one of my tools. Yes.
And I would guess special than chemicals to remove a stain, for example.
That's correct, yes. Lots of chemicals and lots of chemistry is used, yes. That lab, the paper lab that you speak of, which is a state-of-the-art lab, which I credit the entire staff for doing such a great job designing it, that lab has a dedicated chemistry room just for that purpose.
And what will you be talking about with the public tomorrow at 2 o'clock, Seth? What kinds of things can they anticipate in that workshop?
So I'm going to be talking about three main things in particular. So I'm going to be talking about what I do in terms of my field, what types of things that I work on, what to expect from things that are getting repaired. I think I'm fairly good, but I'm not a magician. I can't make things look like they're brand new, and nor should you make things look like they're brand new. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the things that I've worked on, some of the projects I've worked on. Then I'm going to talk about the project on the sesquicentennial project, the treaty documents, and I'm going to be talking about one of the things I'm going to be talking about is that map, along with several of the corresponding documents that went with it. And then I'm going to conclude my talk with some preventative measures on things that as individuals, people should be aware of in order to how to preserve your family records and your family treasures and things to avoid and good practices and bad practices.
Claire, is the workshop free? Do people need to pre-register? And where is it specifically within the SLAMP?
It is free, and people can just show up. It is in the lecture hall at the APK. It's our presentation space, and it seats about 100, so come on down.
Great. We're talking with go ahead, Seth.
Oh, no, I have not. I'll defer to Claire.
All right. We're talking with Seth Irwin. He is a paper conservator. He will be doing a workshop tomorrow via video conference. It begins at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the SLAM. It is free, and it will be in the lecture hall. He will be discussing his six-week effort of preparing some of the historical items associated with the sesquicentennial. Thank you for joining us today.
Can I make one quick correction? It was actually 3 months.
Oh.
It was actually a three-month project.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
January. Yeah, that's okay. I just wanted to make sure. It was actually 3 months.
Thank you. I appreciate the fact check on that. And thank you for taking the time to visit with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. That's my pleasure. Thank you, Claire. And I look forward to speaking with the webinar tomorrow.
All right.
Thanks, Seth.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. In summer, across much of North America, a sudden flash of orange and black in the treetops often means one thing. Orioles. Baltimore Orioles in the east. And Bullock's Orioles in the west. These vividly colored birds return each spring from Central America, and the glint of their orange feathers reminds us of the tropics. Baltimore and Bullock's Orioles are two of the 27 species of orioles found in the Americas. Not only are most of these birds eye-catching, but they also rank among the world's most accomplished nest builders. With slender, sharply pointed bills, orioles weave nests that hang like pendants. You can spot these hanging nests most easily in the cooler months, when the trees have lost their leaves. The nest resembles a 4 to 8 inch woven pouch, suspended from a slender branch. The female builds it in about a week, meticulously weaving long, flexible strands of grass, and adding in man-made materials close at hand. Look carefully at an oriole's nest, and you may discover bits of yarn, twine, fishing line, and even a colorful ribbon the wind carried away from a backyard birthday party. Can't get out to see one right now? Then come to our website for some photos of these astonishingly beautiful songsters and their nests. That's birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Forty years ago, the first barrel of oil flowed down the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
All of a sudden, in the middle of the night, it goes, shh, and I just woke up and I went, oil's in.
Midnight Oil is a new series and podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk about the pipeline that shaped the state. Visit KTOO.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Afternoon. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. My guests are with the Mod Carousel, which is a boylesque performing troupe from Seattle, including our local Seneca Harper, who performs under the name Luminous Pariah, and two of his colleagues and performers, Moscato Ecstatique, did I get it right?
You did.
Thank you. And Trojan Origin?
Original.
Original.
Yeah.
I think I let the L slip off the page. Anyway, there are performances this weekend and next weekend. And tomorrow night, the performances are at 7 and 10 p.m. at Rockwell. Tickets, $20 in advance online, or you can just get them at the door. And then next weekend will be 7 o'clock on Friday and then 7 and 10 on Saturday. So you're here for 2 weekends. And it's not your first time to Juno. I know I have talked to some of you before, so welcome back. First of all, who started Mod Carousel and what was the genesis, the idea for creating, as you call it, a boylesque troupe?
Mod Carousel was kind of the twins, the original twins and myself. But what happened is I fell into this world of burlesque in late 2008, early 2009. And then I came to Juno to perform at the Rendezvous, actually in a belly dance show. But I performed a burlesque act. I was very nervous about it. And
because it was your hometown.
Yeah, it was
so
my hometown.
Kind of unusual, like,
exactly.
Oh, how are people going to respond?
Totally.
Sure.
And all these people who've seen me grow up in different stages of life. But it was overwhelmingly positive. So when I came back to Seattle, we created a trio act in a burlesque version of the theatrical play Macbeth. And we really enjoyed working together, and we thought, wait a minute, what if we created a small group and took this group to Juno in the summertime? And it's gone really well, and this is our 8th year coming up here together.
That's a pretty long history for that kind of, I mean, performing and traveling cannot be easy, I would guess, on a cadre of folks, just the stresses of getting the show ready. Describe the show a little bit.
Our first weekend is called Oui Oui. It's a French circus macabre cabaret. And this one is fun. It's kind of vintage inspired. It's very French inspired. Again, circusy. Our next weekend is a little bit more contemporary. There's some sort of leaning more towards the performance art direction. We're bringing up Kayla Bailey, who is a wonderful singer and musician, next weekend. This weekend, we're really fortunate to have Miss Indigo Blue, who is one of the people responsible for bringing me into the world of burlesque.
Moscato, talk a little bit about your entry into this world.
Yeah, so I actually went to school for dance in Seattle, Cornish College of the Arts, and I took a burlesque course there, which was fabulous. That's how I met the troupe, and they adopted me in at that time and as an intern. And just last year, they promoted me to a member.
You graduated.
I did graduate from both school and interning, and it was such a fabulous way to, you know, jump into the burlesque world head first. It was just...
What do you get out of it?
Oh,
tell
man,
me about that,
so
like,
much.
Why that, as opposed to, I don't know, being a bricklayer, so...
I mean, it's just so satisfying, you know, mentally, emotionally, physically, to produce this work that you own and you create as a group or as a soloist, and it's just something to express your voice and your beliefs and your opinions about things going on in the world or just things going on in your own brain and heart, you know, it's... Really
when
satisfying.
You say beliefs, give me an example of like a core belief that you feel you're expressing through your performance.
Just so one thing that I strongly stand for as Moscato is, you know, sensuality and gender presentation. I present as male, but my persona is super androgynous, presenting these very effeminate, you know, persona characters. And I don't like to just stick to one label. I bounce back and forth between like what's masculine, what's feminine, and what does that mean, you know, challenging it.
So line blurring for sure.
Definitely.
And Trojan, how about your introduction to this line of work? What drew you to it and what do you get out of it?
I like Moscato, my brother and I, Paris, we started as professional dancers and we moved up to Seattle to dance. And there's not a lot of paying work, and there's the dance world and the burlesque world are designed very differently. Or in the dance world, you rehearse a lot. Like you rehearse every day for months and months, and then you do a show for 2 weeks, if even, you know, so sometimes it'll just be a one-off. And so then the rehearsal, the amount of work you put into the performance payoff is a very different ratio. In the burlesque world, we get to perform a lot. And so at first it started as just a financial move because there was a lot. We weren't making that much money through dance just because it's a very poor world to begin
sure,
with.
Sure, it's a very narrow niche.
Yeah, and then I got introduced to it just as like, there's this other performance we could be getting into and it pays. And so then we started doing it And then everything else fell in line after that. And just as Moscato was saying, in the dance world, you make someone else's vision come true. And then in the burlesque world, you make your own vision come true. You're completely culpable for everything you make, but you also are it's your vision through and through.
You mentioned it as a financial move. Are all three of you making your living then as burlesque performers?
I think we all have separate avenues of income, but for the majority, like we are performers first and foremost.
And do you travel in the Northwest, Seneca, or is it primarily Juneau? Talk a little bit about your touring schedule.
Touring has been one of the things that has brought me the most joy that I've ever experienced. So we do as much as we can. We've had residencies in London, a couple times Australia. We've bounced around Western Europe. I just got back from headlining a show in Vienna, Austria. I debuted an act in Utrecht in the Netherlands. I'm headed to Finland to headline a show on a boat on a river. So it's just really exciting. I try to go as many places as we can. And as a troupe, we also put our feelers out there to feel, you know, where can we mobilize to next? So we've been discussing where our next move might be as far as a Mod Carousel tour. But Juneau has been one of the most exciting places to come back. You know, it's kind of like a homecoming feeling, but also the audience here is really exuberant. Sometimes when you go to places like New York City or Boston or London or Berlin, they sort of have seen it all. They have that kind of feeling, right? Like, oh, I've seen this before. But when you come to places where people are more open and interested in what they're about to see with an open mind, what is this new thing? Then they're much more excited. So Juneau is a really wonderful place to perform.
So Mod Carousel, in its 8-year history, and I know Trojan mentioned the original was with his twin brother, and presumably folks who buy tickets to come see your show would have some predilection and an open mind to see, as you call it, boylesque. Have you noticed a change in attitude in a more generalized way in the 8 years that you have been performing?
I have, personally. I try to keep tabs on what's going on entertainment-wise throughout Juno via social media, but as we know, social media is kind of like a lens, right? Everything gets warped and changed, and some things look bigger, some things look smaller. You never know what all those moving parts are. But what I've seen is that there's a lot happening in this little town. It's really, really great. It's really inspiring to see that happen. It looks like Sigla has been doing a lot here. James Hoagland has brought a lot to Juno in the last couple of years. That has been, you know, things are becoming more sparkly. And there's also, you know, there's always been folk music and bluegrass in Juno, but that also seems to be a great stronghold. And some of my friends are in bands that seem to be doing really well. So as far as a very vibrant artistic community, Juno really, really does have that going on.
You're listening to Seneca Harper. He is performing with Maud Carousel. His performer's name is Luminous Pariah. He's here with Moscato Exotique and Trojan Original. Maud Carousel performs this weekend, tomorrow night at 7 and 10 at the Rockwell Ballroom, and next weekend as well. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having us.
I guess that's appropriate to say.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 7th of July, 2017. It's the birthday of the artist Marc Chagall, born in Belarus in 1887. His father was a fish merchant, and Chagall often put fish into his later work, which he meant as a sign of respect to his father. Moved to Paris, joined an artist's colony there, and in 1941, worried about Nazi prosecution, with the help of the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, Marc Chagall was able to come to America. He did the stained glass window at the UN, the peace window, worked in a variety of mediums over his lifetime, clay, oils, pastels, glass, etching. Marc Chagall said, "I work in whatever medium likes me at the moment." It's the birthday of Ringo Starr, born in Liverpool, 1940. Father left the family. Mother worked as a barmaid to support her son, who was often ill as a child. He had appendicitis and peritonitis. He was in a sanatorium for 2 years, where he took up drumming. He got a job as an apprentice in a Liverpool equipment factory when he was 15. He was playing in a band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, changed his name from Richard Starkey to Ringo Starr. He was an admirer of the blues musician Lightnin' Hopkins, and when he was 19, Ringo Starr seriously considered moving to Houston, Texas, to be closer to where Lightnin' Hopkins came from, and then he got an offer to join a local band called the Beatles, and he did that instead. And it's the birthday of the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein, born in Butler, Missouri, 1907, wrote over 50 novels, best known for his novel Stranger in a Strange Land. It came out in 1961, story of a boy born during the first manned mission to Mars, and he's raised by Martians, then returns to Earth and starts a church and preaches free love. Robert Heinlein called his book speculative fiction rather than science fiction in the tradition of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells. He tried to write about events that could actually happen considering the natural laws of the universe. Here's a poem for today, a tennis poem by Maxine Kuhlman, Prothalamion. The far court opens for us all July. Your arm, flung up like an easy sail bellying, comes down on the serve in a blue piece of sky, barely within reach, and you, following, tip forward on the smash. The sun sits still on the hard white linen lip of the net, five love, salt, runs behind my ears at 30 all. At game, I see the sweat that you're made of. We improve each other, quickening so by noon that the white game moves itself, the universe contracted to the edge of the dividing line you tow against, limbering for your service, arm up, swiping the sun time after time, and the square I live in measured out with lime. A poem by Maxine Kilman, Prothalemian, from her selected poems, 1960 to 1990, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. I'm this afternoon's host, Lori Scandling. Jeff Brown is producing the show. My next guest is one of Juno's well-known celebrities, and that is Carlos Boozer. Carlos, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. How you doing?
We are well, thank you. Now, what year did you graduate from JD?
1999.
That seems
like 30 years ago. But, yeah.
Close. No, not quite. Well, we are always proud to call you our own. I remember I worked at JDHS at the time and remember watching you, and clearly everybody knew that you were headed for great things. And, of course, you ended up working for Coach K at Duke and then playing for the Utah Jazz and the Cleveland Cavaliers, as well as the Chicago Bulls and the L.A. Lakers. You did sit out the 2015-16 year, but this last year you were in China, so you continued to play. Before we talk about the upcoming basketball camp, why don't you update us on what's happening with you professionally? Did you move to China for that opportunity?
Yeah, so after I played for the Lakers that year, my mom had got breast cancer, and so I took a year off away from basketball to take care of my mom and be there for her. My mom and dad live in Las Vegas now, so I was out there going back and forth from Miami to Las Vegas, just taking care of my mom. She's fully recovered, by the way. Thank you guys for all your prayers, and she got a lot of letters and a lot of emails and a lot of Facebook messages from friends from back home in Juneau, wishing her well. We kind of kept it quiet, but she's doing great. And so I took that year off to take care of my mom, and then I got a lot of calls, you know, during maybe like mid-season. Right before the season started to play ball, and I had started working out, and I actually missed playing, and so the opportunity of China came up, and I talked to a good friend of mine named Stephon Marbury, who was a superstar in the NBA for a long time, and then has had an incredible career playing in China and opened up new doors from the other avenues outside of basketball as well. So after having that conversation, I went ahead and decided to take my game over there and try it out. So at the time, kind of nervous about going to China for 5 or 6 months, but it was fun, man. The CBA is a great league, very competitive. I had a great time. We actually got all the way to the finals with our team. We lost in the championship series, but it was a great experience. I got a chance to learn a new culture and try different kinds of foods, which was an adventure in itself. But China is an incredible country, man. I got a chance to play there in 08. In the Olympics in Beijing, and we won the gold medal there. So I was sort of familiar with some of the cities there, but being in the CBA this past year for 6 months, I got a chance to travel all the way around China and see many, many cities, and it was a lot of fun. So right now I'm a free agent, and I got a couple of the NBA teams talking to me, and also got some teams back in the CBA and also Italy and France talking to me as well. So in the next 3 or 4 weeks, maybe 5 weeks, I'm going to make a decision on where I'm going to play.
Where's your heart?
I'm gonna play about 2 more years.
About 2 more. And you're what, 36 right now?
I'm 35, yeah.
35. So, and I think your birthday's in November, is that right? You'll turn 36 then, yeah. So, well, middle age is looking at you. And where's your heart, Carlos? Where would you like to be on the boards again? Would you like to stay in the United States?
Probably. I mean, I'm leaning that way. You know, my kids are here. So it makes it obviously easier to spend time with them during the course of the season. But I really had a really good time in China. A lot of fans over there. My kids actually came out for Christmas, so we had Christmas in China last year during their winter break. But I miss the NBA. The NBA is so much fun, so competitive. And obviously this is one of the best seasons we've had in the NBA. You know, seeing what Golden State did and seeing what Cleveland did, seeing Russell Westbrook average a triple-double. There were so many, you know, emerging stars in the NBA. It was fun to watch from afar, but I think I'm leaning that way right now, if I had to pick right now.
Talk a little bit about your experience in mentoring youth here in Juneau. The Carlos Boozer basketball camp, which will be held at Juneau Douglas High School beginning at the end of this month, has occurred for many, many years. What made you decide to be involved with that?
Yeah, I wanted to come back. You know, I did a camp in Juneau a few years back, and I had been running around with my kids, and, you know, they're very good. They're basketball. They play baseball. They're on travel teams. And I went back when they won the state championship, got a chance to hang out with Coach Houston, my high school coach, and also Robert Casperson, the current high school coach, and some of the players there. And I just missed running my camp. And I saw a need for, you know, me to come back and teach some of the secrets that I've learned along the way. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, there's nobody that makes the level that I met, that I got to without help along the way. And that community at Juneau, where I grew up at, helped me, from my teachers to my coaches to, you know, just, they'd be friends at the grocery store. Obviously, I had great parents, and my siblings were terrific, my brothers and sisters, my friends were great, always challenging me. And I miss it, so I wanted to come back and do something every year. So from now on, I'll have a camp in Juneau every year. And I just want to give back. I want to teach some of the youth back home, like I said, some of the tricks that I learned along the way. And we'll have a couple surprises during the camp. Again, the camp is from July 31st to August 4th. You can go to CarlosBoozerCamp.com and sign up. We have about 130 kids, but it's all ages from 5 to 18, all different skill levels. You know, come, have a good time, tell your friends about it. It's going to be awesome. It's at Joe Douglas High School, and it's going to be a good time.
And will you be there?
I'll be there the whole time. Yeah, I'll be there every day. The entire camp, and I'm trying to bring a couple of friends. A couple of friends have a couple of prior engagements, but I'm trying to bring a couple of friends with me, maybe some surprises, so we'll see. But I'll definitely be there, yeah.
That's exciting. And how old are your own children now?
Yeah, my oldest just turned 11 a couple weeks ago, and then my twins, they turned 9 in July 18th, so a couple weeks from now.
And you have boys and girls?
But, yeah, I got all boys so far.
Oh.
So we'll see what happens in the next couple of years, yeah.
Hey, just a couple more and you got a team.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Carlos Boozer. He is a former NBA All-Star. He's played for 4 teams. He's a Juno Douglas High School graduate in 1999 and twice was an Olympic medalist as well. And Carlos will be here for the Carlos Boozer basketball camp July 31st through August 4th. That will be at Juneau Douglas High School. I assume that's for girls too. Is that right, Carlos?
Yeah, it's definitely co-ed, boys and girls, ages 5 to 18. And there's going to be a lot of kids. It's going to be a lot of fun. I got great coaching staff coming. Obviously, the high school team is there as well. Coaching staff will be a part of it. But yeah, come. We're gonna make a lot of games, some fun games. Obviously, I want to teach the fundamentals. You know, one thing about being a skilled basketball player is you have to master the fundamentals so that you can go on to the next thing. I know everybody watches Steph Curry and LeBron James and Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, all these awesome stars that we have in the NBA. All these guys mastered the fundamentals first, and they're very gifted athletically and able to do more things, but I think that's a foundation for being a really good player. And then we'll also play games. So we'll be very competitive. We'll have a champion in each division and there's a chance to play like a sort of a playoff game, almost like college basketball, like the Final Four. It'll be that kind of environment. And we'll have awards along the way, like, you know, Hustle Award, Best Camper Award, Best Listener Award, things like that, as well as the MVP and so on and so forth. But, it's going to be fun, man. So sign up. Again, it's Carlos Boozer Camp. .com and July 31st through August 4th.
And what's the cost, Carlos, and are there scholarships?
Oh, I'm not sure. It's on the website, though.
Okay.
The website, all the information is right there. Yeah.
What if somebody's needs some financial assistance? Is there a way to secure that?
I think we can definitely help some people out, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you where you're calling from today. You're back in the United States. I assume you're not calling us from China.
No, I've been back home. The championship series was over in about April. I came home. I live in Miami, and I'm home in Miami right now calling from there. But honestly, you called me at a good time. I just got married. I just got married and just came back from my honeymoon, actually. I went to Africa with my wife and went to Morocco and Egypt and saw the pyramids, and I went to Madrid. And, we love Europe, so we went to Madrid and enjoyed that for a little bit, and then we just got back maybe like a week ago, so... Perfect timing.
Congratulations. Well, we'll be seeing Carlos in Juneau at the end of the month. And if you'd like to know more about the Carlos Boozer Basketball Camp, you can look at, is it carlosboozer.com?
carlosboozerbasketballcamp.com.
Just what we said, that whole word, one word, .com. Well, thank you for calling us. It's good to hear your voice, and we'll encourage kids to sign up ages 5 to 18, and it is the 31st through August 4th. If finances are a challenge, can we just say show up and chat with you?
Yeah. Go to the website first, and then I will go from there.
All right. Thanks for checking in with us. We appreciate it.
All right. We'll see you soon.
Take care, Carlos. Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is Kelsey Wood. She is the program manager at the Bridge Adult Daycare Center, which is located on Old Glacier Highway. Is that right, Kelsey?
Correct. Yeah, we're on Old Glacier, right down the street from the Aware Shelter.
And talk about what the Bridge provides. People may not be familiar with the range of programs that the facility offers.
Sure. So the Bridge is a program for seniors and their families. It's a day program, so it allows caregivers to drop their loved one off for the day and get their own things done, you know, run errands, continue to work, and know that mom's in a safe place where there's a full day of activities provided by caring staff. We offer personal care, you know, meals, all sorts of things, you know, anything that someone might need assistance with during the day, we're there for them. And then we also allow elders to remain in their homes and part of their communities rather than being isolated in an institution far away from loved ones.
So when you say we allow elders to remain in their home, does that mean you provide home services as well?
No, we don't provide home services. It's just a day program. So, but we certainly can reference home services and things like that and help people coordinate those services.
I know it is under the auspices of Catholic Community Services.
Correct. We're part of Catholic Community Services in the Division of Southeast Senior Services.
What might somebody expect if they drop a parent or a spouse or someone they care very much about and they're providing some care for them, what could they expect that person to participate in during the day if they come
sure.
to the adult daycare
so
center?
During a day, they would experience a whole range of activities. We might start off our morning with coffee and having a chat, reading the newspaper, playing a game of cards. We'll serve lunch. We play games during the day, you know, beanbag tosses, mini golf, bowling. We have a Wii, and that's really popular with the participants, is playing Wii games throughout the day. It's a good way to get moving. And
it is fun.
Yeah, it's super fun. And then maybe bingo. And then we might have a guest speaker in the afternoon. Or once a week we have a musician come in and do a sing-along with us. So really a little bit of everything for everyone.
How many seniors can the program accommodate?
Currently, our numbers are really low, so we're looking to get more people in there. Our max number is about 14 for the day. So, yeah.
And how many openings do you have right now?
Seven.
So is there a cost for this service, and are there some other expectations or guidelines that listeners should know about, for example, an age requirement?
Sure. So the Bridge is really designed for people over the age of 60 or anyone of any age who's experiencing Alzheimer's or related dementia, some sort of memory loss. And so the cost of the program, we operate on a sliding fee scale, so it's dependent on the person's income. Thanks to the grants that we receive from the Juno Community Foundation, Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, we're able to offer that funding, so we don't deny anyone based on an inability to pay. And when you think about it in terms of you're paying for the Bridge rather than paying for long-term care or for having in-home care, it's very cost-efficient.
And is this a service that someone can take advantage of every day, or are there some limits on your participation in terms of numbers of days that you're there?
No, not at all. So we have some people that we're open Monday through Friday from 7:30, and we just extended our hours to 5:30 p.m., so 7:30 to 5:30 Monday through Friday. You could come every day, or we have some folks that choose to come maybe once a week. If they're interested in a particular activity, they might just come for that one day. But oftentimes we find that people start at one day a week just as a visit, and then before we know it, they're coming every day. So,
what are the challenges of having a mixed population? And by that I mean seniors who may be fully functional, and
mm-hmm.
then those who are experiencing some diminishment of their memory, for example. How do you manage that? Tell us about if there is a difference in how you would program for those participants.
Sure. Well, it actually happens very organically, Lori. We find that people that are more higher functioning cognitively tend to take on caregiver roles and help out others, and maybe someone who's hesitant to come into the program because they think, I'm not there yet, or, you know, I can still do for myself. We have so many things for them to do. You know, if they're interested in gardening, they can help us with the garden. If they want to help us with an art project, you know, we'll let them lead that activity. So it really just happens very organically, and we don't really have to facilitate that much.
What are the most common services that are needed for the elderly in the Juno community? The adult daycare program, the Bridge, offers some services. What are some of the other services that you see available in Juno for those who are aging or those who are helping those who are aging? And what might be some of those services that we need?
Well, definitely the biggest one is housing. That's the biggest struggle for not only seniors, but everyone in Juno. It seems like there's just really a housing crisis, but especially for elders and for people who might not meet a certain criteria. You know, the wait list for the Pioneer Home is so long. And so services like the Bridge, it allows people to remain in their homes and in their communities for as long as possible, maybe while they're waiting to get into a long-term care facility. And it allows caregivers who wouldn't normally be able to care for their loved ones to be able to do so and be able to do so safely.
Are there medical services provided at the Bridge if someone needs help with whether it's an activity or with their medication? Is there someone with a medical background on staff?
Sure. So we're a socially based program, so we're not a medically based model, and by that I mean that our staff are not, you know, RNs or anything like that, but we are able to assist people with their medication throughout the day if they're able to administer it themselves, so we can remind them, hey, it's time for your medication. We'll also perform blood blood pressure checks or weight monitoring, and that's something that when someone's coming in and registering for the program, we ask them what their needs are, and then we do our best as staff to accommodate those needs.
And what's your background, Kelsey? How did you get into working with our elders?
Oh, sure. Well, that's a very interesting question. So I actually started out as a nursing assistant when I was in high school. I started working at an adult family home. So I was caring, at the age of like 17, I was caring for five older women in a home-based setting. I stepped away from that for a little bit. I worked as an EMT for a while and then a surgical tech. And then I kind of decided I didn't like seeing people on the worst days of their lives or when they were unconscious. And I really craved that social interaction. I wanted to get back. And I got back to working with elders. The opportunity became available at the Bridge to become an activity coordinator. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better population to work with. They're so grateful for the services they're receiving. And there's just such an ability to get to know people on a holistic level. You're seeing them as so much more than just a diagnosis, you know, you're seeing a whole person and a whole background and a whole rich history there.
A whole history,
there.
Sure, a whole
yeah,
life.
Absolutely. So that's what I really enjoy about working with senior services.
We're talking with Kelsey Wood, and she is the program manager at the Bridge Adult Daycare Center. Does the center use volunteers, and do you need volunteers?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for asking. Yes, we definitely could use volunteers. So specifically, we're looking for anybody who has musical talents or perhaps somebody who would be interested in being a guest speaker. If you have a subject that you're really passionate about, we recently acquired a laptop and a projector for the Bridge, so that allows us to bring in more guest speakers. So just get a hold of me. My number is 463-6171, and we'd be happy. Whatever your interests are, I'm sure we could find a place for you at the Bridge, and there's definitely an opportunity for people to volunteer.
And do you have an online presence? Can someone learn more about the Bridge at a website?
Absolutely. So on the CCS website, CCS
and
Juno.
And CCS, we should say, stands for Catholic Community Services.
Correct.
If you need
yeah.
a kind of a memory assistance.
Sure.
There,
so our website is ccsjuno.org. And from that CCS page, you should be able to navigate to the Bridge's page. And actually, on our webpage, we have a really beautiful video that was put together a couple years ago on the Bridge. It's about 5 minutes long, and it just gives a really good overview of what our services are like. It does a little snapshot of the facility and some of the services that we offer.
And what is the address again on Old Glacier in case folks want to swing by? And may they come in and take a
absolutely.
Tour?
Absolutely. Come in, take a tour. It's usually best to call ahead of time just in case we're out on a community outing, so we do that sort of thing too. But the address is 1803 Glacier Highway, and we're a big green building right next to the Caravan Dispatch Office.
Okay, so your direct line or a good phone number is 463-6171. You can find out more about the Bridge Adult Daycare Services at ccsjuno, all one word,
correct,
.org. Or swing by if you can call ahead first, that's helpful, but swing by at 1803 Glacier Highway if you'd like to take a tour. And it sounds like right now you have about 7 openings?
Correct. And so the way that it works is you get 3 free introductory visits to the program. So come by, join us for lunch, sit and have a cup of coffee with us and get to know the facility and our participants. I think people would be really surprised at what we have to offer.
And can folks drop by at any time during the day, or do you recommend a full day drop-off where they arrive at a certain time, or is
no,
it really open on that?
It's very casual. We want to meet the needs of our caregivers. So whatever works best for your schedule, we'll make it work with ours.
All right, Kelsey, thank you for
thank
joining
you so
us.
Much.
We're talking about the services provided at the Bridge Adult Daycare Center. It's on Old Glacier Highway, and Kelsey Wood is the program manager. You've smiled throughout this entire interview. I can tell you enjoy what you do.
I definitely do. I'm very passionate about it.
Well, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. We'll be back on Monday afternoon with the Juno Afternoon, taking a quick look at our weather. It looks like that sunshine is evaporating a little bit. We can expect some widespread rain showers this evening with lows in the mid-50s, and the same pattern tomorrow and tomorrow night, and probably on Sunday too. So get your vitamin D right now. Don't forget, it is First Friday. Lots of activity happening downtown, and you can pick up a brochure and a map over at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council to find out what's happening on this Friday around the Capital City. My name is Lori Scandling. Thanks for joining us today on a Juno Afternoon, and thanks to Jeff Brown, who is the show producer.
This is Stacia Harris from the Year of Kindness Steering Committee. As part of 17YOK, all sorts of groups are adopting specific weeks during which they do something to help spread kindness. This week's group is the Rainforest Recovery Center. You can sign up for a week by emailing 17YOK@junopolice.com. Together we can...